Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for MedTech companies. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm McDonald Hopkins. Building MedTech companies the right way based on great technology is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable MedTech technologies with their business goals. This, in turn, builds those clients into successful, thriving companies with strong experience and depth in the startup, venture capital, and intellectual property and fundraising arenas. McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the MedTech business that you envision. In this episode, our guest, Lissa Tallman at Flashfield, and I discuss market research, when you should think about doing market research, the different kinds of market research, AI and machine learning in market research, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Lissa Tallman.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
All right, Lissa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Lissa, an introduction into who you are and what you do at Flashfield.
Okay. Well, I am the executive vice president of research and analytics at Flashfield. We are a company that does market research. We can do market research for anyone, but we do a lot of work in the pharmaceutical industry, particularly with drug products and medical technology. And the goal is to help companies determine what the strengths of their product are in terms of the market, how best to sell their product. You could do market research for how to price your product. You can do market research in to determine, what the market space is for your product. Like, is there space in the market at all? So there's like a lot of different ways that you can use market research in order to figure out how best to position your product while it's still in its inception. And then as you sort of go through the life cycle of bringing it to market and then monitoring how it's doing post-launch.
Awesome. And so how did you get into the field of market research, right? Like it feels like there's no degree to say, oh yeah, I'm going to go in for market research. So kind of walk me through your background and how you got into that.
So my background is complicated, as you might be able to tell from my LinkedIn profile. So I have a doctorate in anthropology, and that's from the City University of New York. I'm actually trained as a paleontologist. That's my original training. People always ask me, so in that case, you study dinosaurs, but I never studied dinosaurs. I studied mammals. I studied primates in particular, humans and primate evolution, which is pretty different than market research, as you might guess. But that was sort of my training. But a lot of what I did was really based around biostatistics. You need complicated modeling and biostatistics in order to model the way that organisms evolve over time. And it turns out that those are a lot of the same statistics that you use to determine how markets will evolve over time. So I ended up making a switch from academia into market research, and I leveraged a lot of the same skills that I learned in my original training, but now for a totally different field.
Yeah, very interesting. So the books, let me see, they're over my shoulder here. Uh-huh. Like Homo Deus and Sapiens. Uh-huh. Have you read those books before then?
I haven't. I've read Sapiens, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I was wondering, I'm sure that's like right up your alley. Very cool. Okay. So Flashfield, you said you do a lot of market research on in the med tech space, and you also said pharma and biotech. Curious for the market research, like when clients are trying to figure out what their, is there room for their product on the market? Mm-hmm. Are you engaging them at the problem ideation phase, or are you engaging them once they've said they're like, years into this and now they're looking at, is it still a fit? Like when are you engaging a lot of people in the process of solving an issue, I guess, or a problem?
Anytime. It could be anytime. I would say, okay. There's always a time for market research, but in the sort of ideation process, I think that's a really important phase, because doing market research at that point can let you know what is the appetite in the market for whatever product you're considering. So if you think about the competitors, like let's say you have a new device, but there's already some competitors in the market, you can do some analysis to understand what the demand would be for a new product, what the strengths of your product would be over the other products that are currently on the market, and then what are some things about your product that might be weaknesses that would make people not want to adopt it. So you can do all of that in that sort of ideation phase to determine whether or not, determine whether or not it's even worth bringing a product to market. Maybe there's not space. Maybe you're better off rethinking, what the product is going to be. Sometimes we've done work like this for drug companies when it comes to deciding whether or not to do a clinical trial. Like, is there appetite for a new drug that's coming to market? If so, how much better does it need to be than the current products to drive adoption? And then what's the cost benefit analysis there? Like, how much would it cost us to create a trial that would, and then how much revenue would you expect to gain from that product once it comes to market?
And I guess take me through this process too, of how you're going about doing this market research. Because I think for me, that's like, it's a tad confusing for me. So it might be confusing for listeners as well. When, mm-hmm. when we talk about, hey, doing some market research, a lot of these companies are already talking to a key opinion leaders and trying to figure out, is there a fit in the marketplace? So, what is that process look like when you have a third party go out and do some of those things?
I mean, key opinion leaders are great, right? They're going to drive, they can drive opinions in the market, of course, since key opinion leaders, right? But there's still only one person or two people or maybe four, right? Like, so it's great to get their input, but doing a wider market research product gives you, or a wider market research study gives you the opinions of 100 people that might be willing to adopt your product. I mean, it could be doctors, depending on what the device is. If it doesn't need a prescription, it could just be consumers. It sort of depends on the space of the product. But we found that key opinion leaders will often lead the charge, but the question is, you can't bring something to market with key opinion leaders alone, right? You need broader uptake in order to get revenue. So doing market research gives you a sense of, what's the uptake going to be in the broader population? How fast is it going to be?
Yeah. And so when you're kind of doing these, are you doing this through like a survey, or what does that process mm-hmm. look like?
It could be an online survey, or it could be a focus group, or it could be a series of qualitative interviews. It really depends on the aims of the project. Online surveys, quantitative surveys are really great for talking to a lot of people and getting big sample sizes. That means more statistical power. Qualitative interviews are really great for going deep and getting more of the whys. Why do people like your product? Why might they adopt it? Why are certain messages resonating with them? So you get more of that why situation. And then focus groups, I think, are especially great if you're interested in something like group dynamics, trying to understand who in a group of people might drive uptake of your product. You know, who's the most convincing? So I think focus groups are really good when you want to get that sort of group dynamic piece of it.
So next question, I guess, is would you also potentially use some of these surveys and research to see how your messaging and your brand is targeting specific clients, maybe once you're on the market?
Yes, absolutely. So we do a ton of that. We would go through and test, we could test messages alone. We can also test some kind of core visual aid. So, and then we could understand, what messages are resonating with particular segments of a population? Why are they resonating with those? We can tell you what your best message is. So if you only have time for a 5-minute elevator pitch, what's your one best message that you can deliver? We also can say, let's say you have 10 minutes. What's your best set of messages that you can deliver to somebody in order to maximize your reach? And then if you have a half hour, we can tell you what the best flow is through some kind of visual aid when you have more time to really talk to a stakeholder.
Yeah, awesome. And how are you getting these participants? I think that's like the other piece to me that I never was quite sure is, I understand the need for everything, but how do you get people to partake in these? Is it kind of like the clinical trial world where you're looking for volunteers, or do you incentivize them? Walk me through that process.
We incentivize. Most people aren't willing to do something for nothing. The incentive, of course, depending on who we're talking to. So sometimes the incentive can be as small as, a drawing for a $25 gift card to Amazon. I'm sure after you're done with customer service interactions, you've occasionally gotten emails from companies asking you to complete a survey in exchange for being enrolled, in exchange for the opportunity to be put into a drawing. So it could be as little as that, or, it could be a lot more depending on who you're talking to. There's a fair market value that, for paying for an interview. And so that, or a survey response, and that fair market value is usually determined, by something that's not going to be, it's not going to be so high as to be compulsory. I couldn't offer somebody $1 million, even if I had it, I couldn't offer someone $1 million to take a survey. But I can offer someone like $100, if that's a fair market value for that profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Kind of switching subjects a little bit. When you're doing these surveys, these focus groups, these different types of interviews that you're doing, is this industry kind of like adopting AI and machine learning? And if yes, what does that look like now, right? Like, I just think of I saw an advertisement yesterday on TV for these glasses that are like using AI to help your eyes focus depending on where you're looking, right? And it's just like, whoa, that's crazy. But then it got me thinking about, how much are people watching facial expressions and eye movement? And, is that something that's deployed in this industry as well? Or walk me through that.
Absolutely. Yes, we do. As an example, I love that you mentioned the facial expressions and eye tracking because, we can do user experience research. And so we could have somebody go through a website and we could see where their eyes are looking. Where do they go to first? How many times do they visit a particular spot? We can also capture micro expressions. So we can say, we could do this with an advertisement. Let's say you're making an advertisement. We can measure what kinds of expressions do their faces convey when they see particular images? Is it surprise? Is it concern? Is it happiness? Is it confusion? So we can do all of that, and we do. You can, like I said, you could do it with websites. We can do it with advertisements. We can even do it with just messages. So if you have a series of messages on a page, you know, we can track how much time does a respondent spend on an individual message? How often do they return to it? And what's their facial expression when they're viewing it? So it gives you a sense of, you know, what they might find most interesting or compelling, what they might find confusing, you know, what's worth a second look.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other question I had too was, yeah, very, 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 very good. Adding that in. Yeah, that's intriguing. I'm always curious on like how AI machine learning is being, you know, molded mm-hmm. into certain industries. The kind of circling back to, you know, startup companies, and like the effect of, I guess I'm thinking of branding, right? I've seen quotes for, website redos and build outs. And I've seen quotes for, you know, branding updates from like a big marketing firm and, you know, they're crazy expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, you could spend six figures on a rebrand, no mm-hmm. problem. And so, you know, are you working a lot of times with some of those marketing agencies to say, hey, love your idea, but the thought process here, it's not working out the way we think it should. You should make this adjustment, right? I'm just trying to think of, rather mm-hmm. than having a full build of something on the marketing side and then go to you all and you guys say, hey, it's not working the way you thought. Can it be more of an interactive process? Do you have that happen a lot?
Yes, we often work with marketing agencies, absolutely. And sometimes we do research in two stages. We'll do a first set of research that helps inform the way that, say, a rebrand will work or ways that stories or messages are developed. And once the agency then is done with that, we'll go back and then test it and see how it did. So we definitely do a back and forth we've worked with a lot of different creative and branding agencies. So yeah, that's definitely something that we do frequently. And I think that partnership is really good too, because it helps the agency not work in a vacuum with what they think is going to be right. You know, it allows them to know what's going to go over well. And then it gives some backup at the end to make sure that the product is testing well in a larger sample. So we'll usually do a qualitative interview first, or a series of interviews first, and then we'll do quantitative after they've completed their work.
Got it. On the market research side, is data sometimes a difficult piece of this in terms of like inaccuracies amongst the data? And I guess I'm thinking more towards like, you know, market size or number of procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, we oftentimes, when we talk to medtech companies, we focus on that aspect of it. How much of that is like an issue for you in your work, where it just comes to like down to infrequencies in data or misinformation? I'm sure this has to be an issue. And I'm guessing, you know, how prevalent is that? And then how do you combat those issues as you're doing some of this baseline market research?
It's kind of hard to know when there's quote unquote inaccuracies. You know, if you're talking to a surgeon and you ask them how many procedures they've done, and they say they've done six procedures in the last month, I mean, is it exactly right? I mean, maybe not. but they're usually not bad. I would say the biggest thing that helps reduce inaccuracies in the data is asking for concrete numbers in a short time span. So people are typically better at remembering something that happened in the last month or the last 2 months or 3 months than they are in the last 6 months or the last year. So you could ask somebody, okay, how many procedures have you done in the last month? They say, I've done six. Okay. So something like that is going to give you a better estimate than asking, you know, how many have they done in a year? So there's things like that you can do that will reduce sort of inaccuracies in the data. But, you know, we're in the end, we're all human, right? And no data is perfect when we're dealing with human recollections and human emotions. So at some point, you have to sort of live with a little bit of uncertainty and build that into whatever your models are. So, you know, you can say that doctors say they average 6 per month, but we're guessing it's really between like 4 and 10 based on the body of work that we have from the primary market research, plus maybe some secondary data.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. you know, another question is like between is has to do with assumptions and biases, I guess, is like when you're asking these questions. We had Daniel Hawkins on our podcast, who is the he was the founder and CEO for a number of years of not Wavemaker. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, I'm blanking on the name now. He's currently at Avail Med Systems. You know, he was talking, he's been around all these companies and they've all been wildly successful. And I asked him, I said, you know, surely you can't just be picking the biggest problems to solve each time. And he said, no, but when I'm doing customer discovery and problem discovery, more importantly, I don't take all the answers for face value. I always try to think about, well, what assumptions are they mm-hmm. making? And if they are wrong about those assumptions, how would that change their answer? And you know, this kind of this exercise. And it was fascinating to think about, you know, hey, you can ask a lot of questions, but just be aware of when they're answering a certain way, the assumptions they're making. And if those assumptions are wrong, how could that change the outcome? Is that something... I'm sure you could. Can you build your surveys so that you take out the variability of assumptions? And then also, do you kind of help your clients design questions, surveys, you know, whatever market research around that, so that they're getting accurate data with as little,
absolutely. I mean,
factors little factors as possible.
Yes, definitely.
Or variables.
I think that's a really important point is that the data that you get back is going to be no better than the tool that you create to collect that data. So whether or not that's an online survey or a discussion guide, you know, when you do a qualitative interview, we have a discussion guide, right? We have a series of questions that we're trying to get the answer to. And it's really important that you lay out your assumption. Like, you have to lay out what is the case that you are specifically, you know, interested in, so that the doctors are responding based on the assumptions that you want them to have, right? So that takes a little bit of skill and finesse in some cases in building the survey tool or the discussion guide. You know, sometimes we think we've got it, you know, like we think we've got a great survey and we get data back and it looks really wonky. And you think to yourself, what could possibly be going on? And sometimes the answer is that your assumption about how that particular market works is wrong. And you have to go back and retool or add some explanatory text to make sure that the doctors or consumers are answering the question in the way that you want them, that they're making the assumptions that you want them to be making when they're answering.
Understood. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other piece that's like the flip side of what I was thinking about too, is how do you make sure you're asking questions mm-hmm. that give them freedom to give you an honest answer, and you're not leading them down a specific path, mm-hmm. right? Similar to, like, you know, you watch a line of questioning that like an attorney might give in a courtroom, and they're clearly leading the witness, or they're leading the person they're talking to mm-hmm. so that they draw a specific conclusion that fits their narrative, even though, you know, they all say they're not doing that. But yeah, just curious on, you know, like, I guess that is the flip side of like making sure you're getting honest feedback and not what you want to hear. Because that's another issue with startup companies too, is you start to fall in love with your product, and
yep.
it's very easy to fall into like confirmation bias, rather than getting the feedback you're paying for. Feel free to comment on the confirmation bias piece of that too. Is that something you see a lot?
I do see a lot of clients believe strongly in their product and they don't like necessarily to get bad news, but sometimes getting the bad news is really important, right? Because you can't make your product better unless you know, what the weaknesses are and why somebody wouldn't want to begin using it, right? So I think that that's really important. In terms of qualitative interviews, it's really the discussion guide should always be written so that they are very open. So the questions are very open-ended. And a skilled moderator will be able to probe in places or, ask follow-up questions that get at the information that you want without leading somebody down a particular path. For a survey, the best thing to do, an online quantitative survey, the best thing to do is have closed responses. So a lot of times it makes sense to do qualitative work before quantitative work so that you know what some of the responses should be based on the qualitative research, and you can give those closed-ended responses in a survey, because people only have a certain attention span. I see this a lot. A lot of clients want to put the kitchen sink into an online survey, but truly, once you get past 45 minutes, you are going to end up with respondent fatigue. Nobody wants to take a survey that's that long. Honestly, I think the sweet spot is closer to like 30 minutes, but you could push it to 45 if you had to. But much longer than that, and you're not getting really good answers at the end of the survey. They're just clicking through to finish it. So knowing what are the important questions, keeping those answers more closed, open-ended respondents take a lot more cognitive load. You have to really think about it. You have to type this long, long answer rather than just picking an option. So thinking about those things also helps to reduce respondent fatigue, reduce the cognitive load of your survey, but still make it really accurate and really informative and impactful.
Great. Lissa, is there anything else that we didn't chat about today that you kind of see, common errors I don't know if it's common errors or your best piece of advice, or there was a major topic we missed that you're like, hey, this comes up all the time in our discussions. Was there anything we missed that we didn't chat about already today?
I think the most important part of market research is understanding what the question is. We would help with that too, but a good market research agency is going to help you crystallize the question, because once you have a clear question, then the pieces start to really fall into place. Then it makes sense. All right, now we can design a study that answers that question. We can do it rigorously and we can do it in a cost-effective manner. But I think a lot of times, especially when there's a lot of stakeholders, there's a question even about what are we interested in? What is the main question that we're asking? So I think that's also really important. I think it's important to always get all your stakeholders on board too, so that there's internal alignment before market research, so that you know that you're getting the answers that everybody needs and not just meeting the needs of one stakeholder over another. I think those are some really important pieces that are not really about the actual data collection itself and more about the setup. But I think that's really important, and a really important step that sometimes gets a little bit overlooked.
Great, thank you. So Lissa, thanks so much for your time. I'll have a link to Flashfield's website in the show notes. So depending on the platform people are listening into, up or down an inch, it'll be right in there. Mm-hmm. I also have Lissa's LinkedIn in there as well. But thank you so much for your time today. Hang on for 1 minute and we'll chat offline. But thanks so much for doing this.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.